Okay, good morning, everybody. So this, if you can, or if you would, flip in your Bible or scroll on your smart device, what have you, to Mark chapter 4. And we're going to start verse 35. We're going to end out chapter 34. But just for anybody who either is newer, or either you've been kind of hit or miss, because I don't know what, something must be in the water, because everybody I know, for whatever reason, in like this weird little time in between the end of summer and the beginning of fall, like when Missouri's still trying to make up its mind about what it's going to do weather-wise, a lot of people have been traveling, so we've got quite a few people who've been kind of hit or miss. So we're going through a study on the Gospel of Mark, and it's presented by Francis Chan, as you just saw, and we're just kind of slowly making our way through. And before I get into what I'm getting ready to talk about, I think it's good, like I said, if you're new or if you've been hit or miss, to address a couple things about the Gospel of Mark. Okay, the Gospel of Mark is a really odd book. I mean that on every level. It's weird. And there are a lot of weird books in the Bible, like Revelation and things like that, but Mark is just a weird gospel. It really is. And for whatever reason, a lot of, and it has to do with dating and stuff like that. I'm not going to get into all that jazz, but a lot of people think this was the first gospel ever written and this and that. And it's a really old book. It's dated back to like 60 or so AD, so like only maybe 25-ish, 30 years-ish after Jesus ascends. So this is still fresh within people's memory, so maybe that's why it's so short. I don't know, but it starts off weird. We don't get any of that nice like cushion and stuff we get with the other Gospels, because Matthew's like, okay, so here's a genealogy, and Luke goes, hey, here's a genealogy, and John just says, oh, hey, let's equate this all back to Genesis, and Mark just says, okay, so there's a dude named Jesus, and he started doing stuff, and that was, like, you're just in it. There's no buffer, there's no, like, we're going to tiptoe our way into it. It's like, okay, so here's John the Baptist, and he's a dude that lived in a cave, and he wore camel skin, and he ate bugs, and that's where we're going to start. And it's just a weird place to start, and it's a really short book. Like, it just shotguns a lot of information at you. There's basically no filler in this gospel. It's just Jesus did this, 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 then he's executed, then he's buried, and then he's just gone. And that's what you're stuck with. And it's just bizarre. And the thing is, it seems to be written a lot like a persuasive argument, okay? So if you have made it successfully through middle school, high school, and or got your GED, and then you went through college or whatever it is, if you've at least gone through middle school, you know what I mean by an argumentative paper, where you want to just like smack your head against a wall because you're wondering how many times the teacher could say the word thesis, and it's annoying, right? So he just starts off by saying, okay, here's the point for writing the book, and it's this random Jewish guy who spends all of his time building small tables, because they didn't eat with regular tables, so little bitty tables, in Bodank Nowhere, because I grew up in Eugene, or not grew up in Eugene, but I went to school in Eugene and hung out with people in Mary's home. So I know what Bodank Nowhere looks like, and Nazareth looks a lot like Bodank Nowhere, right? That guy building small tables in the middle of nowhere, somehow the God of the universe. That's where he starts you off with, and then just proceeds to shotgun a lot of information at you. And then randomly in the middle of the book, here's what gets really weird, because whenever you read it, just keep two things in mind. The first one is, Mark intentionally writes this thing where Jesus asks, like, an audience that he would have actually been speaking to a question. And then Mark just always tends to write it in such a way that it seems as though he isn't trying to get you as a reader to intentionally interact with Jesus yourself. Like, the questions are never just like, okay, so then Jesus just kind of gave some vague statement to this particular group of people. It's written very openly, right? So there's a definite context, there's a definite audience that he was speaking to, but he also writes it like he's intending for you as the reader to hear the question, very potently. So randomly in the middle of the book, right, Jesus just kind of, so Mark gives you the point of the book, gives you the answer that this Jesus is the Christ, and then randomly in the middle of the book, Jesus just goes, hey, so who do you say that I am? So he then poses the question in the middle of the book, and then at the ending of the book, there's little to no closure. He's just sort of gone. That's not the way you write a persuasive paper. You get like a solid 60% maybe. I don't know, not enough to do an F because the other stuff's like good, but it's confusing. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And that's just what we're left with, though. So the first thing to keep in mind whenever you're reading the Gospel of Mark is that whenever Jesus seems to be saying stuff, it's written very openly to where you as the reader, because he's trying to persuade you that Jesus is Christ, just internalize Jesus' questions whenever you read through it. Then at the same time, Mark's also writing to a bunch of Greco-Roman people, and so especially if you have an ESV, just try to count the number of times that the word authority or something close to the word authority comes up. It's almost nauseating, as if Mark was trying to say something. Literally, anytime Jesus does anything, it's usually followed by, and they were amazed because this man had some new kind of authority. And he just keeps hammering it in. There's authority, there's authority, there's okay. And this is all happening to a culture that's very authority-driven. There's a very strict hierarchy to Roman culture. You don't mess with that. And then all of a sudden, Jesus comes in and he starts messing with it. But the author seems to think he's got the authority to where he's allowed to mess with it. So just kind of keep those things in mind throughout the whole study. But now we're kind of in this point where, whenever we're getting to this point in the chapter 4, verse 35, up to this point, Jesus has literally been teaching and preaching and healing for days or weeks, for a long time. And he's constantly surrounded by people. Up to this point, there's at least a few different phrases where it's like, and people were consistently pressing in on him to where he literally didn't even have shoulder room. Got to the point where he started backing his way up to the water, and you think normal, sensible people would be like, well, he's wading around in the creek with his sandals. Maybe we should stop pushing. They don't stop pushing. So now he's got to get into a boat and get away from them a little bit so he can actually talk to people. Right? This is what he's constantly been doing. And he's had little to no food or water to the point where whenever these crowds are pressing in on him and they're like going to his house and everything, his relatives, like his mom and his brothers and everybody else, are just like, dude, what are you doing? You got to eat something at some point. What are you doing messing around with all this stuff? Like, be normal. Like, try to be a healthy person. And he just, you know, gives them a vague statement of like, don't worry, these are my brothers and sisters, I got this. So this is just his lifestyle for the last little while. He's just constantly bombarded by people all the time. And as you might expect, he's tired, like really tired. Like I've been tired, I can't even imagine this kind of tired, right? And so he's just saying, verse 35, we're gonna start in there. It says, on that day when evening had come, he said to them, so said to the disciples, let's go across to the other side. And he's making reference to the Sea of Galilee. And they're leaving the crowd. And so they took Jesus with them in the boat, just as he was. And there were other boats with him. All right, we read a little bit later that he's asleep with his head on a cushion. And so here's the point that most people don't seem to realize. And it makes a point right there of saying they took him with them just as he was. All right, Jesus still doesn't get a breather. He goes, okay, we're going to go from here to here, and in the meantime, I'm going to get some sleep, you know? Like if you're on a work trip, and you're just like, I'm going to get sleep on a plane, or I'm going to get sleep on the bus, or whatever, because I don't have time to sleep any other time, so I'm going to sleep here. And it's just probably very uncomfortable sleep. I've never slept on an old-fashioned sail/rowing boat with just a pillow, but I can't imagine it's too terribly comfortable. But that's what he's doing. He's getting to sleep then. Because he's exhausted, utterly exhausted. And so it says that while they were going along, and these boats could have had both sails or oars, who knows? I don't know which way they were going across, but they were going across, and Jesus is sleeping. And it says that a violent windstorm, a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep, on a cushion. Okay. So, Sea of Galilee. It's kind of a misleading name. It's called the Sea of Galilee. It's a big old lake, is what it is. It's just a big lake. You can see, if you're standing on one shore, you can see every other part of the shore from one point on the shore. But it's a big lake, right? This thing gets, I think, roughly 200 to 250 feet or so deep. So it's, I mean, it's not your grandpappy's lake, but it's not a sea. But it's a weird, weird lake, okay? Like everything else in the book. It's really weird. Okay, so this thing, this it's called Lake Tiberias now, but the Sea of Galilee, it sits like maybe 600 to 700 or so feet below sea level. And then on top of that, it's in like a weird bowl almost. Like you could see in the video where Francis Chan was on the boat, there's like a ridge on every side. And now I don't know if you are aware of this, it's hot in Israel all the time. It's hot. Okay, so the air sitting above this water, also pretty hot. And out of nowhere, because of its just because of the way it sits geographically, it's so bizarre. And like scientists go to the Sea of Galilee all the time just to study it because it's so weird. These huge, huge gusts of cold wind, like 70 plus mile per hour cold winds, will just go shooting through the lake or right across its surface. Now, a little bit of sciencey mumbo jumbo. When there's already hot air here, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, cold air comes in and hits it really hard. You'd think it's air, so it all just plays nice together, right? No. The cold air comes in, and the hot air, it just hits it like a brick wall, and it's either going up or it's going straight down into the water. One of the two, but there's going to be a very violent reaction, right? This hot and cold air stuff. We here in the Midwest get violent reactions of hot and cold air suddenly hitting each other. They're called tornadoes, right? So this happens on this lake, and it just randomly causes these massive, massive windstorms. And out in the dead center of the lake, I'm not talking like right next to the shore, but in the dead center of the lake, you will get waves that are like 5 to 15 feet high, just out of nowhere, and it just comes up on you. Because the wind can just gust through at any particular moment. Because I was watching this video of a it was John MacArthur talking about how he's sailing through on there on a regular, normal, like, two-day boat. Pretty big boat. And they literally had to leave the part of the boat they were standing on because of one of these random windstorms and go to a safer place on the boat because, like, 10-foot waves were crashing over a normal, regular, like, today-sized boat with an electronic motor and all kinds of fancy things on it. And it wasn't just like 12 to 15 people in a small wooden boat with some oars, right? So whenever we say there's a great windstorm, all those weird like Jesus movies that came out in like the 60s and 70s and stuff, it's always just like people are in like this little bitty rowboat, like shoulder to shoulder, and somehow Jesus stands up in this random rowboat and he's just like, peace, very quietly to the water, and it's weird. It's like, this is a decent-sized boat. There's like probably 15 or so people on it, and they got like a small fleet with them. All right, it says there's other boats with them. So there's a lot of people following Jesus out here in the water. And all of a sudden, this windstorm just happens. And during the whole windstorm, Jesus just seems to be asleep. Now, I mean, these guys are following him. They're trained fishermen, so I'm going to assume they're used to sailing. They grew up on the water, probably a lot of them on this particular water. They know how to do it. Just let the man sleep. We're going to keep on sailing. And the waters just keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse until finally they hit the point of desperation and they just give up. Like, I would imagine they're probably sitting there trying to yell instructions over to the other boat if the other boat doesn't have as many trained fishermen on it. And they're trying to make sure everybody's fine. They're trying to make sure nobody's getting swept overboard. The thing is rocking violently. I don't know if they're trying to sail a particular way, if they're trying to row a particular way. I have no idea. I'm not a sailor. But I would imagine you hit a pretty desperate point if you are a trained sailor and your last instinct is to look at the sleeping guy in the back of the boat and ask him, and get this, his profession is to build small tables, to look at him and say, what are we going to do? I think you've hit the point of desperation. Okay? My dad is an awesome electrician. If your house is so messed up that he can't fix it, he's probably not going to come to me, who has my like biblical studies slash like theology degree, and go, hey, I don't know what to do with this house wiring. If he does that, then your house needs some help, right? They're hitting a point of desperation. And you know it's a point of desperation because you got to look at the question they ask him. It's not, they don't wake him up just to say, hey, can you hold a rope or something? Hey, can you do something helpful, useful, instead of sitting there sleeping? They look at it, the first thing they just decide to ask him, let me see here, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Right? So, and I like it. I normally don't, I like Greek and Hebrew stuff, if you don't know, because I'm a Bible nerd. I'm like a card-carrying Bible nerd, which is like sometimes the reason why they ask me to preach. The whole licensing me thing, too, is probably a pretty good indication, too. But in the Greek and the Hebrew, I especially like this sentence, this being in Greek, because it comes across very, very snarky. It's like there, it's like, why don't you seem to care that we're dying? No, it's like, it's written in such a way to where they basically super passive aggressive, right? There's just enough time to be passive aggressive in the storm that's killing you to just go, oh, I'm sorry. Are we bothering you that we're dying? Like, that's the way they would have said it, right? That's the way it comes across. And the whole point is, we get the benefit of hindsight. A lot of people are really hard on the apostles whenever they go back and read. But the whole point is, as just from one person to another, I don't know if I can really blame the guys. I've never personally been on a small boat in the middle of a violent storm, you know, but I would imagine it gets pretty heated. And they're only in this mess because they decided to stop their normal day job of like fishing, which is way easier than this mess, and then go out on this boat with this random dude who's just been teaching them for the last while now. They're only in the mess because of him. So they've just, it gets to them, and so they ask him a snarky question. I can't necessarily blame them. And then here's the other thing. It's not just that they're physically desperate, okay? There is, if you were an ancient Hebrew person, they have this particular idea that large bodies of water are symbolic of some sort of untamable chaos. Right? Like if we go out there, anything can happen because it's not dry land. We can't predict what it's going to do. And there might be things inside the water, like spiritual beings or physical things inside the water that try to kill us. And this imagery is painted all throughout the Bible, and it's super subtle, and you might not notice it because we're 21st century people, and we don't have a strange fear of large bodies of water. Well, I kind of do. The first time I was ever on a boat and I couldn't see the land anymore, whenever we went to Southern California, it was really trippy. It's like, I don't like not being able to see land on some side of the boat, right? But the whole point being is, if you look in Genesis, God, whenever it says God or his spirit is hovering above the face of the deep. And that's a reference to just this large, untamed, chaotic mass of water. Right? And then if you go skip all the way to Revelation, whenever it talks about the new heaven and the new earth, this very sort of just all this symbolic imagery, there's no longer any seas or oceans. There's just a stream that runs through it, right? And it's just all throughout the Old Testament. There's all this imagery of God conquering the deep or the waters, right? So not only are they in this physical peril, it's probably in the back of their mind that there is also, because we hitched ourselves to this guy, there's now some sort of spiritual or demonic thing that caused these winds to flare up, and we are now going to die. I could have stayed home and kept fishing. Instead, I'm out here with this guy, and he's asleep. And the whole point being is, there's a lot of times where that, and it could be, you could currently be in this time, where that feeling feels like the norm, right? That feels like the norm. You are constantly in over your head, and you've got this, and it could be even more annoying because you could be like the disciples, right? You could be a trained person to handle your situation. Like, you might be an accountant, and you've got like X amount of savings accounts, and you've got the X amount of dollars because you know how much you need to save in case you lose a job, and all of a sudden just something out of the blue, totally out of the blue happens, and now you're sitting there and almost all those accounts are drained and you still don't have a good lead on a job. Or it could be that you've got some sort of relationship in your life where you're like a good, normal, stable, healthy person, and you started in a good place, maybe started in a bad place. And you just keep going and going and going, and now all of a sudden you are over your head. Or it could be anything. Maybe you're not a trained person to handle the situation. Maybe you're like the other random people who thought, this guy seems pretty interesting, I'm going to follow him, right? And you're on one of the other boats, and you're just having to sit there and helplessly watch as this whole thing careens out of control around you. And you're like, I can hold a rope. Like, you can't do anything to stop it. It's just out of control, and you're just stuck in the middle of it. It's not your fault. You're just stuck in the middle of it. Maybe you're just not really trying that hard. Like, maybe you had a really good, awesome relationship going on with God or with Christ, and now all of a sudden you're out in the deep and you can't really understand why you're here anymore, like the disciples. They're just like, I thought this was going to be awesome. It was awesome when we started. Cool stuff was happening. Now I'm out here on a boat in the middle of a life-threatening scenario. And at some point, if it keeps going and going and going and going, we're people. It's only natural that you're going to hit the point of asking this particular question. You know, it's not just like, God, this is a really hard time. I need out of this. It's like, no, they've just full on acknowledged, they just know what their fate is. And they finally just go to Jesus and just say, hey, why don't you seem to care that we're dying? And the word there isn't just dying, and I swear this is my last like little Greek thing. It's a word there that it's apolumethe. And that word means utterly destroyed, right? Not just like, oh, we're gonna die. It means we're going to be pulverized by the weight of the water, and our bodies are gonna be lost down there, and the boat's gonna be lost down there, and there's not gonna be anything left of us. They have done what they were asked to do. Jesus comes to them, says, follow me. They follow him for a bit. Some neat stuff happens. Now they're on a boat, and they are in a desperate situation. They can't seem to remember or know why he even called them out of there in the first place, out of their one situation, which seemed just fine. Like, they were probably totally content fishing, and they're minding their own business, and he comes along, and now they're in the middle of this horrible situation, and I'm just trying to ask you to empathize with this here, because I feel like it's, at least at some point in your life, you've been in over your head and you can't understand. And they have now just got to ask God the question of, why don't you seem to care? Not that you're uncomfortable, not that you don't like it or prefer it. Like, no, why don't you care that I'm dying? You don't seem to care that I am going to physically, and because of the whole spiritual element with the water, spiritually die. This is literally going to be the end of me, and I'm out here because of you. And they turn around, and Jesus is sleeping, right? Like, God's just asleep, and he's not even at the wheel. We're at the wheel. He's just, who knows what he's doing, but he can't be bothered because he's sleeping, and he doesn't seem to care that I'm dying. But it's when they ask that particular question of, hey, why don't you seem to care that I'm dying? And Jesus wakes up. He says, and he awoke, And people try to say, like, oh, Jesus calms the storm. It's just this miracle. There's like, there's two separate miracles happening here. Like, he gets up and he says to the wind, hey, stop. And then he looks, and now if you've ever been on water that's been acting up, or if you've ever even just slapped your hand into some water, the water takes a minute to calm down. So he looks at the wind and he says, hey, stop. And then the boats are still going to be going like crazy. That's like the wind is just the other one of the problems. So then he looks down at the water and says, be still. And the water just quits moving. Like the whole lake just stops moving all of the sudden. And it says there, and note Jesus' response is that, you know, these guys are drenched. They thought they were going to die. Their adrenaline's going. They're probably like shaken and whatever else, and they are still trying to process what just happened. And Jesus isn't just like, guys, my bad. I was real tired. I slept through the alarm. Peter, did you get your brand new iPhone wet? Do you have the insurance on it? No. I'll replace that for you. I'm sorry, guys. Did anybody lose a Sperry in the waves? Like, no. He stops this, and then he just turns around at them, and he says, why are you afraid? And they're, I don't know if they even had time to think, but it's just like, well, I think that's self-evident. And then the follow-up question is, have you still no faith? And it just says that they were filled with fear. And they ask, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Right? So there's not an apologetic response. They were literally going to die, and I don't know how I would respond in that scenario where I'm literally going to die and find the God, like I'm literally looking at God, and he answers, and he just goes like, what are you afraid of? Like, well, I am not stronger than a 15-foot wave, so I'd say that's what I'm afraid of. Or I'm not entirely sure of what to do when a bank account hits zero and rent's due the day after, or whenever other things just seem to be crumbling apart. That seems to be what exactly I'm afraid of. And I would imagine they probably tried at other points to wake him up. Right, like my wife tries to wake me up multiple times just for something like take out the trash, you know. So like, if you're physically dying, I'm sure they probably tried to wake Jesus up a few times. Right? And the question that actually gets him to wake up is whenever they say, "Why don't you seem to care that we're dying?" And that's when Jesus responds. And he responds by, why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? And it seems to be that that particular question, you know, like, why don't you just wake up at, hey, Jesus, we need your help. Teacher, the water's on deck now. We should. Teacher, the back of the boat's like underwater at least a third of the time. And no, he woke up at, we're dying. Because, and from what it seems to me, is that when they hit this particular point, God needs the disciples, he needs you, he needs people to understand that his number one concern all throughout Scripture seems to be the dying state of his people. Right? He's not necessarily concerned with, like, I'm uncomfortable, I could use some other circumstance. He doesn't seem to be roused by, this is getting kind of flustering, can you help me out? He seems to be roused by, I'm dying. And when there's that acknowledgement of, I'm dying and I need you to do something because you don't seem to care. And Jesus doesn't seem to have an apologetic response. And I think it's in part because Jesus is literally physically on the planet because God's concern was the fact that those disciples, whether they knew it or not, were dying. And in a moment of desperation, they questioned every motive, the sole motivation of why he was even physically with them on the planet in the first place. Jesus is getting up and he's responding and he's saying, my concern at all times is the fact that you are dying. That's why I'm here. And he stands up and he calms this stuff. And it's already incredible just like on a physical level to think this guy just calmed a storm and then the water. But for them, he also in that moment, because God in Genesis literally tames the deep. He tames the chaos. He tames the ocean and he hems them in with land. Like this is something that God conquered. So he's symbolically doing the exact same thing by telling on a spiritual level this water to stop. So then whatever spiritual force was attacking them in their eyes, he just calmed. And they don't seem to get why he's asking them, hey, why are you still afraid? Do you still not have faith? Right? And if they're cold and wet and probably pretty shaky and freaked out by what just happened, I mean, at least if that were me, I would be thinking, like, faith in what? Right? Like, a lot of people read this passage and you get like that cheesy, like, the only way I can hear it in my head is like some southern, like, Colonel Sanders sounding dude of like, you just gotta go through the storms of life with Jesus. Like, something like that. Or they're just like, I've even read books where the author's trying to say, imagine what blessings the apostles missed out on by not just simply having faith that they could weather. Well, they tried everything and now they're dying. I don't think the point of the passage of this particular passage is what would have happened if the apostles didn't do that. The point is what actually happened, right? And I think like a lot of us, whenever we hit that point of desperation and we cry out to God and he doesn't seem to give us an apologetic response, we don't get it either. What exactly am I supposed to be having faith in, right? Am I supposed to be, you know, if I'm going through a hard time and I don't get the result I want, am I supposed to just, you know, like be praying more? I don't pray that much. Maybe I can pray some more. Am I supposed to fast more? Like, am I supposed to volunteer for more stuff? Like, do I need to, like, have all of the presets in my car be like the whatever the three different Christian radio stations are, like, so that way whenever I hit the static on one, I flip to the other. Because Lord help us if you have 106.1 on there. Like, well, you don't know what to do and you're trying to get the proper result, right? There's one other person, there's plenty of other people in the Bible, but there's another person who in the Bible hits this point of desperation. And he, on multiple different occasions, asks God, because the man literally loses everything. It's Job. He loses his kids. He loses all of his wealth, his workers. Like, literally, he loses everything. And then he might as well have lost his wife, because his wife just comes in and just goes, you're so pathetic. Why don't you just die already? Like, come on. Right? So he literally just loses everything. And he spends this entire book then being told by his friends, you've clearly done something wrong here, when he didn't do anything wrong. And he doesn't understand why he's in this mess, why he's in this hurt, why he's in this pain. And he's asking God, like, why is it that bad people seem to do well? And good people like me will just have everything ripped from them and you don't seem to care. I need you to come here and answer me that question. Why did you ruin my life whenever I was just trying to make you happy? And God does show up. And God, even in this particular moment, he even speaks to that imagery of the ocean or the deep, right? And he starts talking about the Leviathan. It's like God trying to say, this is the stuff that I've conquered, right? He doesn't give Job like, I'm sorry, Job. I missed that. That was an error in the system. I was supposed to give you more stuff, not take it away. It was a rounding error. No, he just flat out shows up and he starts naming all this amazing stuff that he's ever done. And just like these apostles in this boat, God starts taming this chaotic mess, the sea, and he just says, can you draw out the Leviathan, this massive just sea creature that Hebrews would have feared lived out there that could kill them both physically and spiritually. So he says, can you draw it out with a fish hook? Can you press down on his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? And will he make many pleas to you while you speak him soft words? Will he make a covenant with you, and can you take the Leviathan for your servant? Will you play with him like a pet bird, or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him, and will they divide him up among the merchants? Will you fill his skin with harpoons and his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him, and you will remember the battle, and you won't dare do it again. Behold, the hope of man is false, and he is laid low even at the sight of the Leviathan. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir it up. Who then is he that could stand before me? Who has first given to me that I'm obligated to do something for him? Whatever is under heaven is mine. Right? And that's a pretty brutal response. Like, I think Jesus had the more tame response of like, hey, why are you afraid? Why do you still have no faith? And Job just gets chewed out. Like, God just lays into him, right? And the disciples who get the nice, like, plushy response of like, why are you afraid? They don't get it. They're just scared of whatever just happened. And if you keep reading on in the book of Job, Job has this incredible response where he, like, God just tells him all the stuff he's created, and he tells him about the fact that he's tamed the behemoth and that he has conquered the Leviathan, right? And that he doesn't owe things to people. And Job, for whatever reason, after hearing that, because that's a real good apology, God, he just says, I spoke about stuff I didn't understand. And I had always heard about you, but now I see you. And he starts worshiping God again. And at first, that always confused me. I really like the book of Job, and I never got that. And I'm sure there's a lot more there than what I'm about to say. But this is a good thing to say, like, teaching is always an interesting experience, particularly if you teach teenagers, because sometimes they just like drop these golden nuggets out of their mouth and they don't even realize what they just said. And you as like a leader will just sit there and be like, hold up, right? Because that always confused me. And I was talking with a bunch of the high school guys and we were walking through this, and that was the response. And I was just outright telling them, this response even confuses me. And Ethan, if you don't know who Ethan is, he pops around in here from time to time because he's at SBU at the moment. He sits like right in that region. He just looks at his Bible, and I've been pondering on the book of Job for like 2 straight years now. Like, why on earth would Job respond that way? Because I wouldn't have responded that way. And Ethan just looks at it, and he just closes his Bible, and he just goes, well, maybe Job just kind of realized that God can do all that. Maybe he knows what he's doing with me. And like, my mind was just like blown. Right? Like, if you all ever watched the meme of like that cat who gets the flower like stuck on its head and it just like its eyes give him, right? Like, that was me. I was just like, holy cow. Maybe that's the point. Right? Maybe that's the point. Maybe Jesus' whole point, because like, if I was sitting in that boat, I would be like, faith in what? Right? Because some of us try to sit there and say, well, maybe if they just somehow in their head would have already known ahead of the fact that Jesus was going to, you know, do this great thing. Or maybe if they just prayed, maybe they could stop the storm or whatever. I don't know. Maybe if they just prayed hard enough. Maybe if they just fasted hard enough. Maybe if I have like these weird outward pious marks of faith, like maybe if I can muster them up, God will be happy with me, right? And guess what? A lot of people really talk about faith that way. Like I'll hear people on TV all the time try to say, if you just had the faith, some miraculous thing would happen. And people talk about faith as if it's like some kind of like muscle, right? Like maybe if I do enough curls, like faith curls, like enough Bible drills, right? I can work a miracle. Right? I'm like, maybe if I do A, B, C, or D, God will be happy with me and it'll be good. Like I can just have this faith that does something cool and makes me somehow magically understand horrible, awful moments. And like, I'll just, yeah, that's not the way the Bible talks about faith, right? As if it's like some sort of monetary amount. Like if I, it's like we're exchanging with God, like I earn enough faith and then I trade him like 50 faith bucks for a miracle. Or like I trade him all of my faith for like a momentary bit of joy. And that's not the way Jesus even talks about faith. And throughout the Gospels, Jesus says, you got faith the size of a mustard seed, like this big faith, teeny tiny little faith, you can move a mountain. Right? And then the Hebrews says, you wouldn't even have faith if God didn't give it to you. Right? As if you're somehow going to muster up faith that you can't even have unless he gives it to you in the first place. Right? So whenever he's sitting there and he's saying, do you still not have any faith? He's not talking about some magical spiritual mumbo jumbo that had they prayed more or fasted more and done more cool spiritual stuff on the shore that by the time they got to the water, they could have done something awesome. You know, like calm the storm themselves or anything. And he says, do you still have no faith? And they don't seem to get it that he's asking, do you not have faith in me? Because they ask him, why don't you seem to care that we are dying? They question his ability to know what his intent is with them. And he does this incredible thing in front of them and they just don't get it. They're saying, do you not have faith in me? Right? Because Job only seemed to summon. Job never got an apology. He never got an answer. Right? And it says that God restored his household to him. Right? But I would, just because he gets new family doesn't mean he's not going to miss the kids that died. He doesn't get any of that back. And yet, for whatever reason, this idea of, I didn't realize I shouldn't touch my face if I'm wearing the microphone. That seems self-evident now. Job seems to get it. And the disciples, it just goes right over their heads. And we're just being begged as a reader to get it, right? That whenever Jesus is talking about faith, he's not trying to get them to just be cool, better spiritual people like the Pharisees or the Sadducees or whatever. He's not trying to get you to do more spiritual, pious stuff, you know? Like God's not just suddenly more happy with you because you went from putting your hands on the back of the seat in front of you to like worship teacups this week, right? And like God is not more happy with full-blown like Keith Smith worship than he is with like T-Rex worship, you know? It's not about some weird, like, pious thing you can do, and all of a sudden God just, things go better, or God suddenly makes things make more sense, or this or that, or like you get promised all this garbage and mumbo jumbo, right? He's trying to say, do you have faith in me? That I know what I'm doing with you, and I know what I'm doing for you, and my number one concern at all times is that you were dying. And I came here to keep you from dying. And you're going to be in more scenarios throughout your lifetime, probably, where no matter what you do, it doesn't work out, and these waves are going to be coming up in over your head, and you're not going to have any idea what to do with it. And guess what? I'm God. I'm over it. I conquered it. He was literally over it in the beginning. The Bible says he was hovering over the face of the deep. He wasn't even touching it. He was so over it. That unknown, that chaos, that stuff that just paralyzes us with fear and we don't seem to understand who Jesus actually is and that his concern at all times is that you were dying. And he's come here to see to it that you don't die. And even whenever you get this agonizing feeling of, I don't know what's going on, I need you, and you don't seem to care that I'm dying, and that you're asleep at the wheel, and I'm only in this mess because of you. Right? And I demand an apology. That's probably not going to go well, because God doesn't, he seems to have this pattern of not giving some sort of apology or not feeling like he has to explain every little thing that has ever happened in your lifetime to you. He just seems to be concerned with the fact of, do you have faith that I know what I'm doing with your life? So if we could, if the band could come up for response time. So in this particular moment, and it could be whatever sort of response you need it to be, whether it's just like reflection, but or whether it's like you've actually got something going on and I just somehow, some way, like spoke to a specific circumstance in your life, I don't know. You're stuck in this, and you got to put yourself in this position of where these disciples are, of where Job was. And there seem to be one of two responses. God, why? And they both just ask the same question. God, why don't you seem to care that I'm dying? And we need to understand, he's always concerned about his people dying. He came here and died for us to be sure that you wouldn't die. And if you're still stuck in that moment, maybe you have no idea, maybe nobody's ever actually like talked through the gospel with you, and you just need to know more about that. Like, I need to know what you mean by God doesn't care, like God is concerned that I'm dying and wants me to not die. Like, if that's, like, if you need to know more about that, then come grab somebody and we're gonna talk to you about that. Maybe if you know Jesus, you have a relationship with Jesus, and you're stuck in this moment of desperation because no matter what you do, whether it's your fault here in the circumstances or not, God seems either far away or distant, and no matter how much you pray or try to read Christian books or try to listen to the Christian radio or like however many times you watch Fireproof or whatever, you still don't feel any better, and you still feel like you're dying. And you're trying to ask, why don't you seem to care that I'm dying? Or maybe it's just honestly, you just have a really, like, life is hard right now. And honestly, like, getting to tomorrow would be a miraculous work. And you're wondering why God doesn't seem to care about the fact that you're dying. I need you to understand, right? He cares that you're dying. That's why Jesus came. And then if you're pushing yourself down further and further in the cyclical trap of like, maybe if I do more stuff to make God happy, he'll suddenly care that I'm not dying. That's not what it is. Stop trying to like take the word faith and just kind of you know, spray paint a faith stencil on pious works, right? And say, look, I did stuff. Now, will you please help me not die? Will you please help me get it, right? He's always concerned about your dying, and that your faithful response to the dying is faith in him. Not faith that the storm is going to end soon. Not faith that my bank account will magically go back to whatever it was 2 months ago, or not faith in a better job, or not faith and whatever the heck's going on in some personal relationship, you guys, just faith in him that he knows what he's doing with you and with your life. Because truth be told, it's totally understandable that sometimes you feel like in your bones that God doesn't care. But he does. And Jesus is the living proof that he does. And I just hope beyond hope that maybe you can just get even like the slightest interaction with him this morning. and that you could have faith in him. So just do whatever it is you need to do. Grab somebody else to pray. Grab David or me to pray. Grab one of the deacons to pray. I don't care what it is. But just interact with Jesus this morning. And hopefully have peace and discover more and more what it means to just have faith in him. Not some magical outcome that maybe you want, but just him. Strip it all else away and just him as a person. Because he's clearly above the chaos and the mess. And he's just trying to show you that. Just interact with Jesus this morning in whatever way that looks like.